The headlines: Iran's foreign minister warns against the presence of Israeli terrorist elements in the region as he arrives in Russia to meet with the country's officials. The Yemeni army says it has downed a Saudi spy drone in the southwestern province of Marib. And Taiwan's defense minister says military tensions between Taipei and Beijing are at their worst in more than 40 years. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Iran has called on Russia to remain cautious about the presence of Israeli terrorist elements in the region. Iran's foreign minister said his country has expressed its concerns to Russian officials about the developments in the region that can threaten regional peace and stability. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Tehran is willing to significantly boost ties with Moscow. He made the remarks upon arrival in the Russian capital, where he's set to meet with the country's officials, including his counterpart Sergei Lavrov. Discussions on developments in the South Caucasus and Afghanistan will be on the agenda. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says unilateral coercive measures, also called UCMs, are tantamount to terrorism.
Since UCMs mainly target ordinary people, such measures greatly contribute to the root causes of terrorism.
Majid Tahta Ravanchi noted that the measures are undermining the efforts of targeted countries to counter terrorism. He added that the root causes of terrorism are socioeconomic problems as well as foreign military occupation and intervention. Iran's UN envoy stressed that the only way to combat terrorism is through international cooperation. Tahta Ravanchi was speaking at the United Nations General Assembly's Sixth Commission concerning the fight against terrorism. The United States says it believes diplomacy is the best way to make sure Iran never acquires nuclear weapons. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan made the remark during a meeting with his Israeli counterpart. Sullivan said President Joe Biden's administration has made clear that if diplomacy fails, the U.S. is prepared to turn to other options. This comes amid Israel's continued threats against Iran's interests, especially the Islamic Republic's nuclear program. On Tuesday, Israel's military chief said the regime will carry out further attacks on Iranian nuclear capabilities. Tehran says it doesn't seek to acquire, develop, or use nuclear weapons, but will not hesitate to give a crushing response to any acts of aggression. Political commentator Scott Bennett says the Biden administration isn't honest in its pledge to engage in diplomacy with Iran.
The claims of the Biden administration to engage in diplomacy is, of course, a camouflage and a cover, much as they utilized in the invasion of Iraq in 2003. So Iran is wise to meet these threats with a very calm and serene diplomatic posture that simply posits and presents to the rest of the world: is this what the world wants? Another global war that will no doubt bring in other nations such as China, such as Russia, such as Iran, such as Syria, such as Iraq. Is this what the world wants? A devastating war against Sunni Islam or Shia Islam? Is this what the world wants? Another mass exodus into Europe of refugees? And I don't think the world wants that. And I think the history of the Biden administration and the devastation that it's allowed in Afghanistan is another evidence of its senility and its inability to do any sort of coherent foreign policy or military policy.
The Yemeni army says it has downed a spy drone belonging to the Saudi-led coalition in the country's central province of Marib. Army spokesman Yahya Sarei said the aircraft was shot down by a surface-to-air missile in the Ajuba district. Meanwhile, a Saudi artillery fire targeted a car in the Saada province, which led to the death of three civilians. It also left several others injured. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. The war has so far killed tens of thousands of civilians and displaced millions of others. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdullatif Al-Washali, has given us more details regarding the downing of the Saudi drone. Let's take a listen.
Yemeni army managed to down this drone by a fit weapon, as the spokesman of the Yemeni army said. This drone is capable of firing air-to-ground missile from altitude of 5,000 meters, so this drone can stay outside of effective range of most anti-craft guns, and this is why this is this operation is a big deal. The Yemeni army downed before many of this kind of drones, and this drone is produced and manufactured by China. It is a compact a drone, the army of a country which is has been under siege for 7 years now. This drone was implementing hostile actions against the people of Marv and also against the Yemeni army.
Six Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails keep up their hunger strike to protest their administrative detention. Two of them have been transferred to hospital over their deteriorating conditions. Our correspondent Mona Kendil reports on that.
The hunger strike of six Palestinian prisoners who have refused to eat for days have once again brought the plight of Palestinian prisoners to attention. The six are on hunger strike to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention, demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them.
Israeli prison authorities refused to deal with the hunger strikers' legal demands. Kaid al-Fusfus has been on a hunger strike for over 82 days. Mehdad al-Ghawasmi for over 76 days, and both were transferred to Goplan Hospital. Ala al-Araj as well has been transferred to Al-Ramlis Clinic. Their health condition is deteriorating, but they insist to continue with their move to end their illegal detention.
In solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners, Palestinians, including prisoners' families and relatives, have protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah. Here, every week, you'll see prisoners' mothers and wives holding the pictures of their beloved ones. They say they are the voice of the prisoners.
My son Mujahid went on a hunger strike and ended it after the Israeli authorities decided not to renew his administrative detention and to release him. Mujahid spent almost 10 years in jail, and then he was rearrested after 15 months of release. His administrative detention has been renewed 3 times. That's why he started the open-ended hunger strike. I know he was risking his life, but that was only for the hope that he could be released to live with us, his family, and to raise his only child.
Administrative detention is illegal. However, it's a tactic that allows Israeli authorities to put Palestinians behind bars indefinitely without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers. Today, Israel holds 4,600 Palestinian prisoners in its jails, with 520 of them under the illegal administrative detention.
Despite repeated warnings about the hunger strikers' deteriorating health conditions, Israel has always been defiant in dealing with their legal demands to make sure that no more prisoner follows the same path in the future. Unfortunately, Israel ends the administrative detention only when hunger-striking prisoners are on the verge of death. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
The U.S. has published the number of nuclear warheads in its arsenal amid efforts to restart arms controls talks with Russia. According to the State Department, the U.S. military maintained over 3,700 active and inactive nuclear warheads. Washington has released the figure for the first time in 4 years following a blackout on the data imposed by former President Donald Trump. Last week, Russian and U.S. diplomats began talks aimed at reaching new arms control accords and to find a successor to the New START treaty. The deal abandoned by Trump limits the number of nuclear warheads deployed by Moscow and Washington to 1,550. Democrat lawmakers in the U.S. Congress have warned against a looming downgrade in credit rating amid a continued deadlock over the country's debt limit. Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer called the potential downgrade disastrous. He said too many Republicans were pushing Washington to the edge of default. The Treasury Secretary earlier said the crisis could trigger another recession. President Joe Biden also announced that Democrats are considering making an exception to a Senate rule to extend the government's borrowing limit without help from the Republicans. The stalemate came as the Republicans vowed to block a vote to raise the government's borrowing cap If the deadlock holds, the U.S. will not have funds to meet its obligations to creditors and could default on its $28 trillion in debt by mid-October. Western military alliance NATO has criticized growing support for a similar organization made up of troops from European Union member states. Earlier, we discussed the issue with our guests in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
The NATO chief has criticized support for a parallel military alliance made up of troops from the European Union member states. Jens Stoltenberg said the European-only force would risk dividing and weakening the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. He described NATO as the cornerstone for the security of the continent. This comes amid growing calls within the EU for a new coordinated military task force. Support has increased for the idea over the past months since Brussels was sidelined by Washington as the U.S. ended its military presence in Afghanistan. Recent security arrangement between the U.S., Britain, and Australia has further added to the chorus of voices calling for a European-only military force. And now joining us for the program is Mr. Mike Billington from the Asia Desk of the Executive Intelligence Review, joining us from Leesburg, Virginia, and Mr. Michael Springman, author and former U.S. diplomat, joining us from Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess, Michael, we'll start with you. Hope you're safe and doing well. Your initial thoughts on this growing, within the European Union itself. It's funny because we heard the European Commission president last week talk about, or not last week, about a week after the last forces got out of Afghanistan, that we need to start taking our destiny into our own hands. And that was before the whole submarine deal with the UK, Britain, and Canberra. Your thoughts on this, Michael?
Sure. Well, talking about Europe and its independence from the United States, to some extent that might be a good thing. On the other hand, the issue is, will we have an American Europe or a European Europe, as former French President Charles de Gaulle used to talk about? It would be good if Europe moved away from the United States and concentrated itself on its own destiny and its own culture and its own politics. However, we've seen Angela Merkel in Germany try to wrest control of Europe and move it in the direction of America and move it in the direction of opening the country and the continent up to waves of migrants.
Thank you. And Mr. Mike Billington, I want to apologize that I didn't clear up which Michael I was referring to first. We have two Michaels. Pleasure to have you, sir. Your initial thoughts.
Well, don't take Stoltenberg seriously. This is just a cover story. The NATO is moving into Asia. They are mobilizing to confront Russia in Europe over Ukraine and China in Asia over Taiwan. They're threatening war. They're threatening a war which could very rapidly go nuclear. And the separate European force, if you listen to people like Mark Carleton Smith, the chief of staff of the British military, they're talking about Africa. They want to drive China out of Africa. They're talking about the Sahel and basically the rest of Africa, which they're saying they need a separate European force. Mr. Springman may think that it would be a good idea to have Europe separate from the United States, but what we're dealing with here is a British run operation, which has drawn the U.S. into this AUKUS, the U.S. British Australian force. We call it ORCUS, which is the Greek word for the underworld, which is more appropriate for this openly military push for a military confrontation with China, one of the most insane and dangerous situations. All of this is backed up by the fact that the entire Western financial system is now in a state of utter collapse and potentially a hyperinflationary collapse, which is now literally driving most of Europe and the UK into penury, quadrupling the price of natural gas. We're looking at a hyperinflationary bust of this system, which has done nothing but print money for the last several years, trillions and trillions of dollars, not for the economy, but to bail out the financial system. And for that, the military-industrial complex needs wars. The pullout from Afghanistan was absolutely the right step by Biden, but the problem is the military-industrial crowd is willing to go along with that as long as it's simply a redeployment into a confrontation with China. That's what the AUKUS agreement is all about. And Stoltenberg is very much a part of this. There is a move for this European force, which, as I said, is aimed largely at the Europeans taking care of driving China out of Africa. But it is literally a justification of this idea that there's no distinction between war and peace. Mark Carleton Smith, the chief of the General Staff, said last week, literally, that we must exploit, this is a quote, exploiting instead the hybrid space that exists between these two increasingly redundant states of peace and war. Artificial and binary characterization of a strategic context that no longer exists today. There's no difference between peace and war. And remember what Tony Blair said after the pullout from Afghanistan, in which they did not ask for the British approval. He said, it's an imbecilic idea that we should do away with endless wars. We need these endless wars to maintain the empire, the control over the developing sector, to prevent China from moving in with the Belt and Road and offering real development to the rest of the world rather than the looting of the IMF World Bank networks and the British imperial policy.
We're short on time, Mr. Billington. Let me get back to Mr. Springman. Now, Michael Springman, Jens Stoltenberg also said that NATO is a cornerstone, pardon, for the security of the European continent. Isn't that the point? The U.S. isn't just in there helping NATO with the security of the European continent. It's actually manipulating NATO at times to push for confrontation with Russia, and it's also using NATO members to join it in an adventurism in the Middle East and now in Southeast in the South China Sea. So it's not just about what the U.S. helps with the Europeans in Europe, is it? Because it's stretching them far and thin.
Well, exactly. The NATO, which has outlived its usefulness, it was set up originally in the 50s to oppose what was then seen as the monolithic Soviet bloc in Europe. And somehow it's expanded up to the borders of Russia, even though American presidents in the past said this would not be done. It's become not a defensive alliance, but an offensive alliance, of course, moving into the Middle East and elsewhere, farther east. I think that it is something that should be disbanded, that it is a dangerous entity, and that it is a destabilizing entity, and that if anyone had any sense, they would erase this horrible creation from the face of the earth.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us. Time has gotten the better of us. Mr. Mike Billington from Leesburg, Virginia, Mr. Michael Springman joining us from Washington, D.C. And that's a wrap for this segment of News of You program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
UK businesses blamed the pandemic and Brexit for the shortage of overseas workers, with 38% saying a lack of regional talent was hurting their ability to recruit much-needed staff. We now present you an article written by Kalina Markotov. The piece is titled Survey Finds Staff Shortages Spreading to All Corners of UK Business. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Survey has warned staff shortages are rippling out from the haulage, farming and hospitality sectors to almost all parts of the British economy, putting severe pressure on medium-sized businesses across the United Kingdom. More than a quarter of the 500 firms polled said the lack of staff was putting pressure on their ability to operate at normal levels, with reduced stock due to the resulting supply chain disruption hurting their business. While some firms had considered cutting production, others were planning to raise prices, leading to concerns over rising inflation as the Christmas trading period approaches. Nearly a fifth said they were increasing wages to attract new staff, while others were introducing extra perks to lure workers. But the report released by accountancy and advisory firm BDO said the knock-on effect for consumers could be significant, with nearly one-third of businesses saying the prices would need to rise in the next 3 to 6 months to keep up with the disruption. More than one-third of firms in the survey said they had also cut down on the kinds of products and services on offer, with a further third planned to do the same over the coming month unless the situation radically improves. A similar proportion expects stock ranges to be affected long term. Businesses blamed the pandemic and Brexit for the shortage of overseas workers, with 38% saying a lack of regional talent was hurting their ability to recruit much-needed staff. BDO partner Ed Duan said, Brexit, global supply chain issues and the long tail of COVID-19 has created a perfect storm for British businesses. Ed Duan added, after navigating the challenges of the pandemic and hoping for some respite, businesses have found themselves facing more major disruption, with those across almost all sectors reporting staff shortages. This is an era of upheaval, and the challenges faced by the UK's mid-tier, the engine of the UK's economy, points to a long road ahead. The survey lays bare the challenges facing all tiers of British business. Heavy goods vehicle driver shortages have already resulted in fuel shortages across the country, while large companies such as Tesco warned recently that the labour crunch could lead to empty supermarket shelves and panic buying in the lead-up to Christmas unless the government relaxed immigration rules. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government has since introduced emergency visas that will allow a potential 300 fuel drivers to arrive immediately and stay until the end of March, and let a potential 4,700 further food haulage drivers arrive from late October and leave by the end of February. Elsewhere, according to the latest business confidence survey from consultancy firm CGA, and technology services firm Forth, the hospitality sector is also suffering from a lack of workers, with one in six jobs currently vacant. Only 18% of the 200 businesses in the restaurant coffee shop industry said they were confident that they would be able to recruit and retain the staff needed to run their businesses. That is a dramatic drop from the 67% who felt secure about their talent prospect just 3 months ago. Around two-thirds said they expect to be hiring staff at a higher rate than usual this year, and were already struggling with absences, reporting that on average about 6% of staff were currently in isolation due to ongoing COVID risks. The shortage is forcing businesses to step up efforts to attract and keep hold of staff, with three-quarters saying they have offered better pay, while two-thirds have tried to cultivate the right working culture to retain workers. Bosses who have increased pay said they had hiked wages by up to 11% on average for current staff and 13% for new hiring. The report said that higher wages, while pile extra costs on the hospitality sector, which was already facing rising food, drink, supply and utility costs. One of CGA's directors, Carl Chessel, said the figures illustrated the full scale of the hospitality sector's recruitment and retention crisis, and called for government support. Carl Chessel said thousands of businesses are now critically short of staff, while many of those who have sufficient labour face a fight to keep hold of it. He added, gaps at front and back of house and fast-rising wage costs threaten to derail the industry's recovery, and sustained targeted government support is now urgently needed to tackle the problem.
Spotlight.
China flew 150 planes over the Taiwanese air defense identification zone. Taiwan regards this as irresponsible and provocative action, while Beijing blames Washington for steering the situation and pushing Taiwan towards segregation. China regards Taiwan as a province and has pledged to take it by force if necessary. It considers President Tsai's government to be separatist. Now, this while Taiwan stresses it's committed to safeguarding its democracy.
Tensions between China and Taiwan have once again escalated after Taipei reported that 148 Chinese fighter jets flew over the island's air defense zone since Friday. That was the day Beijing marked the founding of the People's Republic of China with a military parade. Taiwanese government officials said they have to be on alert for China's, quote, military activities, while Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen, said the island would do what it took to defend itself. This is China regards a self-ruled island, a breakaway province waiting to be reunited with the mainland. It maintains sovereignty over the region under the One China policy. However, Taiwan says it's an independent country and seeks help from the West, especially the United States, to boost its defense. Currently, the U.S. is Taiwan's largest weapons supplier, despite having no formal ties with the island. On Monday, China once again lashed out at the U.S. for selling arms to Taiwan and sending its warship to the Taiwan Strait. The foreign ministry described Washington's actions as provocative and irresponsible, and urged it to stop bolstering Taiwanese separatist forces. Some experts believe the U.S. is hatching plot to further push Taiwan into secession from China.
The U.S. is trying to push the envelope as far as possible, trying all kinds of tactics and measures to push Taiwan forward as if it was a separate country without declaring its former status as a separate country.
The South China Sea is yet another bone of contention, with the U.S. routinely sending its warships, citing its right to freedom of navigation. The U.S. has no claim over the strategic waters, but it misses no chance to play with the sentiment of other countries having maritime stake over there. The U.K., a major U.S. ally, is also not far behind. Last week, London sent a warship through the Taiwan Strait for the first time since 2008. That, despite China's constant warning to the U.S. and its allies over such moves. For years, the U.S. and China have been at loggerheads over issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong and Taiwan, to the South China Sea. But ties between Beijing and Washington deteriorated sharply under former President Donald Trump. China had hoped for an improved relation under Trump's successor, but since taking office, Joe Biden has maintained pressure on China, showing no sign of discontinuing on his predecessor's hardline policies. Biden is even seeking new alliances to counter China's rising influence in the region and beyond.
Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and today we're discussing the China-Taiwan problem. Let's see who's joining me in this episode. We'll have Director of Global Studies at Wayne State University, Saeed Khan, joining us out of Detroit. And from the Executive Intelligence Review, William Joins is joining us from Leesburg. Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Now, Saeed Khan, the Taiwanese president, has warned of what he is calling catastrophic consequences if the island falls to China. What consequences is he talking about?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. President Tsai Ing-wen, Xi, wrote an article in the Foreign Affairs, which is the Journal for the Council on Foreign Relations, in which she warned about catastrophic consequences for the region. I would suspect that this is a bit of hyperbolic language for two reasons. Number one, China is not reckless in the way that it asserts itself, and it is already the dominant force within the Pacific Rim. Number two, I think it's important also to recognize that many of China's neighbors have acknowledged China's power and influence in the region and have signed on to what is known as the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. So they are now bound in a relationship that is economic with China, knowing full well, again, the power dynamics that are at foot. So if China were to then go ahead and assert itself in any stronger way with Taiwan, which I don't think it will, then it's really difficult to see what exactly those kinds of catastrophic consequences might be.
Okay, now, William, China is accusing Washington of, being the provocateur and warning against backing the Taiwanese independence. China says that engaging in Taiwan independence is dead end, and China will take all the steps to what it calls firmly smash any such bid. How serious is China?
Well, it's very serious. Look, China has made a number of commitments. One is that they would not move to a violent reunification of Taiwan with the mainland. I think they adhere to that, but at the same time, they said they would not accept Taiwan independence. So to the extent that there is a relationship between the mainland and Taiwan, which does not include moves toward independence, the relationship should go on very well, as it did for many, many years. But since the Trump administration initiated attacks against China, initially on trade, but then beefed it up with the enhancement of the Asia, so-called Indo-Pacific Alliance, it has sent a message to China that the United States and its allies are intent on building a ring around China, containing China. And part of that, of course, has been moves first on the part of the Trump administration and also continued diplomatically by the Biden administration, high-level visits, which previously were really unprecedented since the United States recognized and had diplomatic relationships with the People's Republic of China. And secondly, an indication that they are going to move closer diplomatically as well as militarily in working with Taiwan. And that's all sending a signal that the United States is reneging on its one China policy and ultimately wants to capture China capture Taiwan as a base for possible attacks against China, and that's unacceptable. So what China is doing with these military forays is really sending a very clear message to President Tsai, who has been playing along with this and who is intent on this independence move, as well as to the United States, which is backing her in that respect, that if they move further in trying to separate Taiwan from the mainland and reneging on the One China policy, then China probably most likely would react militarily. But barring that, they will not. And I think the ball is really in the court of the Biden administration at this point.
I see. Now, Saigon, we also have Taiwan warning that if democracy and way of life, I'm quoting the president, I believe, if democracy and way of life are threatened, they'll do whatever it takes to defend themselves. Does this mean a war is looming?
Well, I think they're certainly going to try to transmit that as being the threat. The problem, though, is that whether Taiwan is really going to have much support from the international community, much of which doesn't even recognize it as being a sovereign state of its own. It has many challenges when it comes to who really wants to confront China in the event that Taiwan wants to defend itself, particularly on grounds of democracy. I think we find throughout the history of the last 72 years since the Chinese Civil War and the Kuomintang established themselves on the island of Formosa, or Taiwan, as was said before in the report, as China perceives it to be a renegade province. The idea is that there hasn't really been much of a constitution for Western countries to confront China. And this is at a time when China wasn't nearly as powerful as it is now. So it's quite doubtful that the rest of the world is really going to come to Taiwan's aid and defense. It doesn't seem as though it's going to be the proverbial hill upon which the rest of the world wants to die. And the second thing is that Western democracies have done a fairly poor job of defending other democracies. If they see some significant self-interest for themselves, using it as a proxy in a way that doesn't have significant blowback upon itself, then we could see that perhaps there's some way of doing that. But in this call to defend democracy and to use military intervention in any kind of direct way, again, I think is perhaps wishful thinking on the part of Taipei right now.
Okay. Now, William, there are some analysts who argue that Taiwan is hoping to provide deterrence to China by building strong international ties and investment in defense capabilities, including arms purchases through the U.S. Is this the right course it's taken?
Well, this is the way things have developed because of the, on the one hand, because of the Shanghai Communique, but also because of the Taiwan Relations Act, where those who were opposed to creating a diplomatic relations with China tried to put the brakes on it to some extent by passing legislation which assured that Taiwan would have the means for defending itself if it were attacked. And that has been the case ever since the 1979, or even from the Shanghai Communique Agreement. And that has occurred. There are always complaints from China as it occurs, because every year there is some kind of incremental increase in that. But that will not cause a war. That is not the real problem here. The real problem here is the attempt to maneuver, to use Taiwan as a tool of getting it at China. And they're playing on the defense. Tsai Ing-wen really is not telling the truth when she says democracy is threatened. She got elected. She got elected in a democratic election. China did not interfere in that. China is not interfering in the internal affairs of Taiwan with regard to the way the Taiwan system works. And the one country, two systems assures that Taiwan will maintain its own system. So that's a false argument. What she's doing now is she's appealing as a so-called victim to try and get the support she felt Taiwan would need if there were a military conflict. The problem is that Taiwan is like a hand grenade in the region. If the Western forces want to try and push for independence, Taiwan will be the first country to go under as a result of that. And it won't just be a regional issue. I think it could lead to a global conflict. I believe that both parties want to stop that, but they are moving, both the U.S. And China also are moving in a direction where a confrontation can very well occur, even though it is not totally intended by the parties. But the real problem here is that we have left the agreements that were made between the U.S. and China in 1979 with the One China policy, and really kind of a hands-off Taiwan with regard to independence. That's the problem, and if that continues in that direction, and you have a more aggressive policy to get make Taiwan independent, then I think there will be a military conflict in the region.
Now, Said Khan, let's now bring in the United States. Why should the U.S. try different ways to push Taiwan to announce independence from China?
Well, I think we see a very garbled American foreign policy toward Taiwan. And in fact, one could argue that this has been the case really since 1979 at the very least. The fact that the U.S. was so quick, if you will, to switch over from formally recognizing Taiwan as the legitimate China to switching over to the People's Republic of China demonstrates a certain mercurial, a certain petulant nature to the United States whenever it comes to opportunity. And this, of course, has a ripple effect because that was also the case at the United Nations. Now, the United Nations doesn't recognize Taiwan. It recognizes that as a de facto independent country. It meets only 5 of the 8 criteria that the United Nations sets for what would be regarded as a sovereign independent country. So there really is no international consensus regarding Taiwan. However, the United States has thrown up quite a few different conventions, if you will, in order to maintain not only this kind of purgatory status for Taiwan, but also a kind of dependency that Taipei has toward Washington for both economic cooperation as well as for military needs. China has been rather tolerant in the past several decades in allowing the United States to meddle into what otherwise would be seen as a national matter with a renegade province, allowing Taiwan, for example, to purchase F-16s. And then, as was just said, allowing for full and free democratic elections within Taiwan to occur unfettered. America's latest big mistake was with the Trump administration pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which, of course, was an agreement intended to then contain Chinese expansion economically and its dominance within the Indo-Pacific Rim. Similar to, of course, what was at least one of the secondary objectives of the Obama administration when it came to the Iran nuclear deal, trying to prevent Tehran from moving closer to Beijing. As you know, the Trump administration pulled the United States out of both the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, as well as the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Right.
In that amount of time, Beijing has only increased its dominance in the region and globally. As a result of this, the United States is trying a bunch of what seem to be hapless efforts to try to contain China. The AUKUS relationship with Australia and the UK ended up having quite a bit of embarrassment because it offended one of their own allies, France, over nothing more than a defense purchase deal of submarines. This is going to be one of the big dilemmas that Taiwan has as it is getting these mixed signals from Washington as to what to do. Washington is not going to go ahead and either formally recognize Taiwan's independence, nor is it really going to allow for Taiwan to put the United States into the position of obligation if Taipei tries to overextend itself by making a declaration of independence. I'm sure that that will fall on several deaf ears to the detriment of Taipei.
Okay. Now, William, as you know, a few countries recognize Taiwan, and also Said Khan mentioned that, but the U.S. has a law that requires it to provide Taiwan with the means necessary to defend itself. What's the deal?
Well, there was a compromise because those who were defending, look, Taiwan was created, the island of Taiwan was created by the United States, which refused to recognize the victor in the Chinese Civil War. Mm-hmm. So that when Chiang Kai-shek ended up there, the United States says, we're just not going to recognize this country of then half a billion people. We will recognize this island kingdom with Chiang Kai-shek as the military governor. And that's why you had this phenomenon of Taiwan, which was a part of China, which was returned to China from Japan after World War II, after the Japanese had won it in their defeating China in 1895, so that they have certain legitimate rights to call this a part of their territory, and they do that. With regard to this legislation, this is simply a means of assuring those who were opposed to the diplomatic ties with China that Taiwan would be protected. Now, there's a certain limit to what is a defensive weapon and what is an aggressive weapon, and that's something that has to be taken into consideration too. China is always upset about any incremental increase of weaponry in Taiwan because this weaponry does increase the danger of a military conflict that they really wish to avoid. But the other issue about Taiwan that you must understand, that if Taiwan became independent, formally or informally, it would be what Douglas MacArthur called the immovable aircraft carrier. And that would be a threat to China. And any military operation by the U.S. on that, of course, would immediately lead to war. But that this is what China fears most, that there is a containment policy coming out of the West, which is trying to strangle their economic and technological development. And it's being continued by the Biden administration. And unless that is changed, I don't see any lessening of the tensions over Taiwan or over any of the other issues which now are a bone of contention between the United States and China. Like I mentioned, it's in the U.S. court to try and show that they are not aiming at destroying the People's Republic of China.
Now, Syed Khan, one last question. What's future holding for this China-Taiwan issue? Is détente on the horizon, in your opinion?
I think détente would be an ideal situation. As William just said, there is always this danger of incremental escalation to a point where then one or both parties feels compelled to act in a way that they had not intended to initially. Hopefully cooler heads will prevail. Right now it doesn't seem to be the case with this escalation by the United States to create defense/military conventions, including AUKUS and then also the Quad. Although the Quad is being marketed as a way of economic and diplomatic cooperation, it's really a fairly unveiled and ridiculous idea that this is not, in fact, a threat to China, also militarily. The one respite, of course, is that the other three members of the Quad are perhaps not as fully committed to confront China in the robust way that perhaps the Biden administration is. And even there's question about whether Washington has its full heart behind that. India has proven to be rather incompetent with its recent issues militarily with China last summer on its border. Mm-hmm. Japan simply has far too much to lose if it is seen as being too robust in its membership in the Quad. Australia is a member of the RCEP. It relies too heavily on China's economic relationship with it, which leaves the United States in many ways having to pull most of the heavy lifting on this. And again, I don't see the prospect of Taiwan being allowed to be, nor does the Washington want to make Taiwan this floating aircraft carrier, as was so aptly articulated. This will lead to, hopefully, an understanding by Washington that it will be at best a stalemate between Beijing and Washington when it comes to economic, political, and military dominance around the world. And that kind of a stalemate is exactly then what leads to détente. in superpower politics.
Okay. And on that note, we'll come to the end of the show. Let me thank our guests. We had Director of the Global Studies at Wayne State University, Syed Khan in Detroit. And from the Executive Intelligence Review, we had William Jones in Leesburg. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال علي عليه السلام الفكر مرآة صافية والاعتبار منذر ناصح وكفى أدبا لنفسك تجنبك ما كرهته لغيرك.
Imam Ali said, imagination is a clear mirror, and the taking of lessons from things around you provides warning and counsel. It is enough for improving yourself that you should avoid what you consider bad in others. Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So we've been talking about the piety of Imam Ali alayhi salam in the past few programs. We've been talking about this amazing and beautiful taqwa, this piety, God consciousness, this awareness of Allah that Imam Ali alayhi salam had. Now, of course, it is unanimously agreed among Sunni scholars and Shia scholars and even non-Muslim historians who write about Islam that in his time, Imam Ali was the most pious man of his time. Of course, Imam Ali has famously divorced the world three times, a divorce from which you cannot return. And we find that he would fast during the days, he would worship during the nights, and after fasting, he would break his fast with dried barley bread. You know, it's important for us to know that this detachment from the world, or this zuhud, which is talked about in these ethical and moral circles, this does not mean that we become paupers, or we become poor people, or we stop going to work, or we seclude ourselves in some dark cave in the middle of a jungle. No, brothers and sisters, we must live within society. We must face the trials and hardships and difficulties